Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It wasn't very long ago when visiting a zoo was more like visiting a living museum. Live animals kept in small enclosures there for the benefit of the public. There has been a radical transformation in recent decades, driven primarily by the AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and scientists, specialists in animal behavior and conservation who have worked to make these changes. Now, animals in accredited zoos are not just kept alive to be put on display, their needs are first and foremost in the development of enclosures and habitats. To help us understand this change, Michael Renner is here. He is a professor of biology, psychology, and environmental science at Drake University. He recently published an article on this topic in The Conversation and the Boston Globe. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And let's go back in time. I mean, I think anybody my age or older can think about visiting a zoo as a child or even as a relatively young adult and imagine exactly what I was talking about. You know, animals in fairly sterile enclosures there to be looked at, but animals that weren't necessarily having their needs met. Let's talk about how zoos really originated and how that style of zookeeping came to be.
That's an interesting question, and it depends on how far back you want to go. The original places that exotic animals were held in captivity were essentially as amusements for, you know, the royalty, the gentry, and they were essentially displays of, you know, look how much cool stuff I have. In the Victorian era, there was a kind of a celebration of the natural world. Part of the Church of England's mission was to understand what they saw as God's creation so that they could celebrate it. And so they actually funded quite a bit of science. And in the British society, it became a common thing and a fashionable thing to have a cabinet of curiosities in your home where you had natural objects on display in a glass-fronted bookcase that would serve as conversation starters. Zoos followed that line. And then sometime in the early 20th century, the idea that they would be a specimen of type, just to show what each animal was like, took hold. And the idea that we should keep these animals healthy and alive at all costs also came as the organizing feature in how zoos were run, which meant that the focus was on making sure they didn't catch diseases. And so that led to what I would call the bathroom tile school of design, where they didn't build anything into a zoo enclosure that couldn't be steam sterilized to make sure that germs didn't live there.
Right, which was great for sterilization and for keeping germs away, but that's a really sterile environment for an animal to live in.
You wouldn't want to live in a hospital operating room either. They're just not much fun.
Right.
And so the change came as we understood the animals' lives better and realized that they could only be representatives. And zoos evolved into a new mission of conservation and education. And to do that, you had to make each animal a good ambassador for its species, a representative of not only what they look like, but how these animals live their lives. And once you start doing that, you start paying attention to what they're doing more than what they look like. And with that came an evolution in zoo philosophy toward what we call a landscape immersion model of zoo design, where you want to see something like how the animal would live its life if it weren't captured. And that led us to start thinking about zoo design in a very different way.
And speaking of looking at an animal's behavior, when people started really doing that, they could see that animals in zoos were struggling. I remember going to a zoo in a Midwestern city as a young person and watching an animal just pace back and forth along the exact same pattern over and over and over again. And it's things like that that led us to understand a little bit about how the animals were experiencing these enclosures, right?
I think so. And my experience was much the same, seeing animals in zoo enclosures as a young person and even as a young professional. The best you could hope for is that they wouldn't be exhibiting stereotyped behavior, which is obviously a sign that all is not well with them. They didn't have enough to do. There wasn't proper stimulation. In many cases, they didn't even have the opportunity to do the things they would do if they weren't captive. And so you saw animals in enclosures where this is an animal that would, in nature, it would climb things, and there's nothing to climb. Or an animal that normally running is a big part of how it lives its life, and there just isn't enough space for them to run at all. We came to understand that that doesn't work. And so zoo design evolved pretty dramatically over about one short generation, so that now the standard is to try to keep animals in an environment that functionally mimics what they would have the opportunity to do if they weren't captive.
Help me understand how that revolution happened, because I can think of so many other areas of life where we know that it would be better to do something better, and yet that area remains resistant to change because of money, because of tradition, because of all kinds of things. How did this revolution actually take hold and happen?
That's a really good question, and it opens a really broad and interesting topic of conversation, in that the people who work in zoos typically aren't paid terribly well. They have to have a college degree to have a credible shot at a job working with the animals. Many of them have master's degrees, and they're there because they are passionate about these animals. They want the animals to have a good life. They want the environment to be conserved so that these animals will have a place to be in the wild and will continue to exist. You know, in the metaphorical sense, they want to be able to show their grandchildren these animals. And when you put on that mindset, the people who are working there are not doing it because it's a glamorous life or because it's, you know, going to make you rich. They're there because they really care about these animals. When you're around them all the time and you see that all is not well with them and you care about them, it's pretty easy to take the step of what can we do to make this better? And, you know, the scientific study of animal cognition and animal behavior had a lot to say about what's a good environment for an animal, what keeps them properly stimulated. And then there was a line of research that came out of laboratory research, which is how I got into this, actually, on the topic of environmental enrichment. What does the animal's environment, the world around it, do to its brain? And it turns out that animals that come from relatively richer environments have brains that are more developed in a number of empirically measurable ways. You can look at the thickness of the cerebral cortex or how interconnected their neurons are, and you can see distinct differences in twin animals based on which environment they grew up in. And that was carried into the zoo world from the laboratory world of maybe we should try this enrichment thing in zoos. And so the idea of making their worlds better started as a kind of an offshoot of laboratory research married with an inherent desire for the animal's welfare from the zoo staff. And that has kind of exploded.
Tell me a little bit about the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. I mentioned the AZA and their accreditation process, and we'll talk more about what is necessary to be accredited in a few minutes. But tell me about that organization, which has become so influential in animal welfare.
The AZA has been around for quite a long time. They started accrediting zoos in 1971. At this point, the USDA licenses animal exhibitors, and they license about 2,800 facilities in this country. Our best estimates are that there really are more like 4,000 things that might qualify as a zoo, from a roadside zoo to a small display, up to, you know, something as enormous as Disney's Animal Kingdom or the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington or Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. And only about 240 zoos are accredited. There is a long and laborious process that involves paperwork, it involves inspections, where you demonstrate that you are meeting the best practices standards in the profession. And that movement toward pushing one another to doing better every year, it has been enormously influential in the zoo world. The AZA started requiring that you be accredited to be a member in 1985, and the next year their membership had dropped 75%.
Wow.
They knew it was coming when they did it, but they decided that they had to do that to make zoos as good as they could be.
So this really is a moral movement, it sounds like. This was not something that was going to make anybody necessarily more money. This was driven by the needs of the animals and the commitment of the people who care for them and study them.
It absolutely was. To be accredited, you have to have significant activity in four things. First of all, you have to have some recreation function that, you know, people want to come and they learn things and enjoy things. You have education, you have conservation activity, which is required if you're a zoo, and you have research. And those requirements are essentially a pact among the accredited zoos that we are always going to push each other to get better. And that has made a big difference in the zoo world over the last generation.
For people who haven't been to an AZA-accredited zoo or haven't been to a zoo in a very long time, can you give me an example of what you would see now that you would not have seen 40 years ago?
When you walk into an accredited zoo, there will be informal education everywhere. There are signs around enclosures that will tell you where this animal is from and what its conservation status is, whether the native population is a healthy size and doing all right, or whether it's endangered, or whether it's close to extinction. You will see the animals held in facilities that give them the opportunity to do the things they would do if they were in the wild. Now, there are different philosophies how you do that. I mentioned the landscape immersion model, where you try to make it possible for people to imagine that they are in the grasslands with this animal or on a mountainside. But you can accomplish much the same thing without creating what looks like a movie set. You can give a climbing animal something to climb on, and it doesn't have to look like a natural object to give them that opportunity to behave in particular ways. So you'll see animals who are better representatives of their species. You certainly are going to see animals that are healthy. You know, the veterinary medical profession has progressed just as fast as human medicine has in the last 50 years. And so we know much better about nutrition and prevention of injury and treatment of disease. There are veterinarians who specialize in exotic animals, and that's a very hard certification to get. But zoos have those folk that are better at keeping animals healthy than they were even a few years ago. A lot of people don't know that a zoo animal statistically has a much longer lifespan than its counterpart in the wild. And that's because they are kept healthy and they have lives that surround them with the things they need for a long and healthy life.
And that definitely did not used to be the case. We are talking this hour about a revolution in how animals are kept, housed, taken care of in zoos. And with me is Michael Renner. He is a professor of biology, psychology, and environmental science at Drake University. He recently published an article on this topic in The Conversation and the Boston Globe. We'll talk more in a moment about this revolution and about organizations in Iowa that are AZA accredited as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about a revolution in zoos, a revolution in how wild animals are kept in captivity. Things have changed dramatically over the past decades, and a lot of that transformation has been driven by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, the AZA, and the scientists who consult with them, who work with them, and work with animals at zoos. We see animals now in these accredited zoos kept in habitats that give them the opportunity to do what they are naturally designed to do. Runners can run, climbers can climb. Animal welfare is the primary consideration. And Michael Renner is here with me. He's a professor of biology, psychology, and environmental science at Drake University. And he recently published an article on this topic in The Conversation and the Boston Globe. And Michael, before the break, we were talking about AZA accreditation and what that means for an organization. Here in Iowa, we have just a couple of organizations that are AZA accredited, right?
True. The Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines is fully accredited. And that process involves being inspected as well as turning in a bazillion documents about every 5 years. The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque is also accredited as an aquarium. And then there is a separate categorization that is identical to accreditation in terms of their standards and in terms of how you must take care of your animals, that is for places that aren't generally open to the public. And there are only 14 of those in the country, and the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines is one of those certified organizations. So it's the same standards, it's just for places that aren't typically open.
And we will check in just in a couple of minutes with the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative and Blank Park Zoo and talk about how their organizations have maybe changed over the years and how they keep these standards in mind when they care for the animals that they have been entrusted with. And Michael, thinking about the standards, I mean, thinking about any given zoo, there are so many different species that are kept in a zoo, and the AZA actually has standards written for every single species that might be in a zoo?
No. They are in the process of developing what they call animal care manuals for starting with the most common species. There are several dozen of these already published, a bunch more in the works. And these are public documents, so that even a place that isn't part of AZA that wants to hold an animal of a particular species would have a way to say, here are the best practices for taking care of this animal. But accreditation actually has shifted really dramatically. In 2018, they changed the rules on everyone. In the past, the rule was, show us you were doing the things that ought to make an animal healthy and have a good life. In 2018, the basis for the rules, the fundamental question they ask, changed from what are you doing to show us that your animals have good welfare. And there are evidence-based ways that you can do that, where you are now required to demonstrate that you manage welfare, that you track it, that you fix things when they are wrong, and that on balance, all of the animals in your facility have good welfare. It gives you more flexibility in how you do things. The animal care standards manuals are still very helpful, but it used to be, clean the cage X number of times per week and you're good. Now, it doesn't matter how often you clean the cage. If it's not clean, then it's not good. And so the standard of changing to welfare as the fundamental basis for your accreditation is a huge leap in the zoo world, and you will see the effects of that over the next generation.
What do you think the effects of that will be?
I think, for one thing, you'll see more creativity. It's not a matter of check all the boxes anymore. You will see zoos experimenting with things, and they won't necessarily all work to make animals better off, but the ones that work will move things forward quickly because word spreads. Zoos talk to each other. There are listservs of elephant keepers and seal keepers. And if somebody learns something useful, either a bad thing to avoid or something good that really worked well, the word spreads very quickly. And so you will see zoos adopting new methodologies of keeping their animals happy and healthy and, as busy as that species ought to be. I think you will see the quality of zoos take another leap forward in the next few years.
We are talking about a couple of fields here where there have been just incredible discoveries and progress made in recent decades, and that's our understanding of animal behavior and animal cognition and this understanding of how to care for animals. This is there have just been a lot of changes and a lot of progress. And for me, it's really fun to talk about something where there's been positive progress recently, because we know a lot of stories don't go that way. But unfortunately, we also know that there are incredible environmental pressures on animals in the wild that are growing by leaps and bounds with each passing year. And we know that there are more and more animals that are in danger of going extinct. And that makes zoos and facilities like zoos even more critical right now, doesn't it?
It does. Zoos have a requirement that they contribute a certain amount of their income to what they call in-situ conservation, meaning conservation projects that aren't at the zoo. And AZA-accredited zoos have given over $200 million to that kind of project around the world. If you look on the AZA website, they have a map of places they have funded projects in the last few years, and there is not a corner of the world that hasn't got a flag on it somewhere. They know that they have to have successful conservation in the wild in order for the environment to survive. And the animals in zoos are representatives of those environments. When a kid has an emotional moment where they connect with an animal, where they make eye contact with a sea lion or with a monkey, That's what they remember when they walk away from the zoo, that personal connection with nature. And when they do that, then taking care of those animals everywhere they are found becomes something they want. And so a zoo that's done well, where the animals are healthy and are good representatives of their species, can inspire a desire to conserve the natural world in people who never thought of that before, and maybe never thought of the connection.
We won't care for what we don't love. So it sounds like you're saying zoos give us an opportunity, especially these zoos that are taking good care of their animals and presenting them in a way that really helps us understand these animals and the environment. Zoos are really important in creating that connection.
You know, preserving a habitat that's 10,000 miles away in the abstract sounds fine. But if you know that an animal that you have fallen in love with lives there, then suddenly you have a much stronger motivation to worry about what are we doing to right the wrongs that have been done and to establish a societal trend that won't continue to damage it. And what can we do to restore it also becomes a question.
Does this evolution in zoos and other facilities that house wild animals, does this give you hope right now in a time where hope can be a little bit hard to find?
It does. I think that zoos are doing a lot more good in the world than they did 50 years ago. I think they've gone from, you know, animated display cases to facilities where people can learn about the world around them. And even kids who never get out into nature because they, you know, live in the middle of a city can develop a connection that will help them understand why the choices we make are important and why it is important that the natural world, even the parts that we can't see, you know, continue to exist and that they be there for future generations.
When people are traveling and have the opportunity to visit zoos, do you feel like it's an important thing to make sure that the facility you're visiting is AZA accredited?
Well, a lot of people saw Tiger King on Netflix, and that's not typical. But there are many places where animals are on display and it's a for-profit enterprise, which is not inherently a bad thing. And getting people in the door and maximizing the amount of cash that flows is far more important than the welfare of the animals that live there. If you go to an accredited facility, you won't find that. And you will find places that are, you know, held accountable by their peers to make sure that the animals there have as good a life as possible. And one little bonus to being a member of your local zoo that a lot of people may not know about is that there is a cooperative arrangement among accredited zoos where if you're a member at Blank Park, you can get into a whole bunch of zoos around the country for free or for half price. And so, you know, if you're a zoo member, there's a way to keep your vacation costs down by visiting zoos all over the country, which, of course, as a zoo geek, I've done.
Well, Michael Renner, thank you so much for helping us understand this positive evolution that's taken place in zoos. And I really appreciate your time.
This has been a genuine pleasure. Thank you very much.
Michael Renner is a professor of biology, psychology, and environmental science at Drake University. And as he mentioned just a moment ago, Iowa has three organizations that have accreditation from the AZA, that's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, the Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. We will check in with them in a few minutes. And Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines is the other organization. And with me now is Anne Shimerdla, president and CEO of Blank Park Zoo. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And, you know, you were just listening to Michael Renner talk about how we have seen these changes in AZA accredited zoos over the last really couple of decades. You have maybe a little bit longer, in fact, and you've been associated with Blank Park Zoo for a long time. So you can give us a little bit of insight. Can you tell me about some of the changes that you've seen at Blank Park over the years?
You're absolutely right. I've been fortunate enough to be a part of Blank Park Zoo and really grow up here within my career. So I started as an intern back in the mid 90s and now have, you know, grown to my position here. And being a part of the zoo industry in general, I mean, we've seen a lot of changes over the years. And I think welfare in particular has been one that has really been at the forefront of our conversations. I really enjoyed what Dr. Renner said, and we're very fortunate to partner with Dr. Renner to help us accomplish some of these things. But our staff are incredibly passionate about the animals at the zoo and really want the best lives for our animals. So when we talk about welfare, this is something that is easy for them to get on board with. So they are eager to continually improve the lives and to really learn how we can do things better.
Tell me a little bit about how that has influenced habitat at Blank Park Zoo for people who may not have visited in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really an interesting conversation because, you know, back in the day when the zoo opened in the 1960s, it was very, you know, people focused. So just like Dr. Renner said, in kind of the evolution of zoos, it was more sterile environments. In the 80s, our zoo closed and transformed into essentially the path that you see now. And then since then, we've been on a process to remodel our spaces as we go, as we continue to evolve and grow. So for example, you know, our largest exhibit that we've built recently is for our Eastern black rhinos. And so those are animals that are highly endangered. We work cooperatively with other AZA organizations to keep a healthy genetic population because their wild populations are declining at alarming rates, mostly due to poaching. And so looking at their space, we wanted to look at all the things that a rhino does. So, you know, our rhinos are browsers. They roll in the mud. Skin care is very important, you know, in their welfare. They are solitary animals, except for a mom and her young. So we've designed three different outdoor spaces for them so they can rotate around. We look at our browse program, how can we provide opportunities for them to do what they would naturally do? So, you know, browse by, you know, morning and evenings, but nap in the mid-afternoon. We look at their space. So do they have, you know, spaces that they could roll in the mud? And then winter becomes an interesting aspect to our care. So looking at, you know, a rhino's from Africa, so winter is not something that they are adapted for. So how can we look at our indoor space and provide them the same welfare or as best as we can to help them through those winter months. So again, looking at skincare, looking at enrichment, looking at their social groupings, looking at their mental stimulation as well as their physical stimulation.
And bringing up the Eastern black rhino, of course, you've been part of a successful program to breed Eastern black rhinos at Blank Park Zoo. That was very exciting for everyone back in 2019.
Yeah.
And shortly after you became part of this program, I had the opportunity to visit the zoo and go behind the scenes as well. And I was struck by how much behind the scenes there is at Blank Park Zoo. And I'm sure that that's the truth at every zoo that is AZA accredited, where there's a lot going on that the public can't actually see.
That's correct. I mean, we all of our animals have spaces I'm going to call it off view from the public. And so that serves a lot of different purposes, but there really is truly a lot of things that happen behind the scenes that maybe people don't realize. So behind the scenes space really serves many purposes. So, you know, one is just providing safety for the animals, giving them an opportunity to move away from the public if they need to. And that's part of self-maintaining. So if they are feeling stressed or feeling uncomfortable, is there something that they can do themselves to help with their own, I don't want to call it mood, but, you know, their own anxiety where they can
make themselves feel more comfortable.
Make them comfortable. Yep, okay. Exactly. And then building those behind the scenes spaces as well for opportunities for us to do training with our animals. So we do behavioral training where the animals participate in their own healthcare. So one of the pieces of welfare is providing that health care. And I know Dr. Renner alluded to that, where animals typically live longer in zoos because they have incredible health care. At Blank Park Zoo, we have two full-time veterinarians on staff that focus on every animal in the zoo. And so, you know, training becomes a part of that. So monitoring their weights. You know, we mentioned our breeding program. We had two successful births with our rhinos, which is a pretty incredible and a pretty rare event when you look at the population across the country. And our female rhino, we were able to weigh her regularly. We were able to do voluntary ultrasounds with her. We were able to do blood draws so we can check her vitamin levels to make sure she maintained a healthy pregnancy. All the things that a human would receive when they're pregnant, our animals receive.
We only have about a minute before we need to go to a break, but one of the other things that I have gotten to see change at zoos throughout my lifetime is that there also seems to be an emphasis on putting species together that would naturally live together in the wild. That's something you've also done at Blank Park.
That's right. You know, our Discovery Center is a good example of that, where we have, you know, different bird species that, you know, are together, or some of our aquariums. But what would be, kind of going back to that education piece, how do we connect people to the natural world and give them opportunities to experience what it would be like if you were to see them out in nature.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Anne, please stay with us. Anne Shimerdla is president and CEO of Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. We're talking about how the care of wild creatures in captivity has changed pretty dramatically over the last couple of decades. This is Talk of Iowa. Long trunk swinging and we can stay all day. We're going to
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about how the standards for the care of wild animals in captivity have changed dramatically over the last few decades, driven primarily by the AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And there are three AZA-accredited institutions in the state of Iowa. In a few minutes, we're going to check in with another one of them, the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. But with me right now is Anne Shimerdla, president and CEO of Blank Park Zoo. And before the break, we were talking about the welfare of animals within the zoo and how that has become a major priority for Blank Park Zoo and other AZA-accredited zoos. I want to talk just briefly before I let you go about your role in conservation initiatives as well, because that's another innovation that we've really seen with zoos in recent decades, where zoos have become extremely involved in trying to promote the welfare of animals in the wild.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can learn from animals, both studying them in the wild and in their natural places, but also at the zoo itself. And so we participate in a lot of different ways in conservation, from breeding programs, keeping that healthy genetic population, which we've already talked about, to advocacy and education of the public, to providing safe havens. So we have several different species at the zoo that were injured in the wild and considered non-releasable and need a space to live that is safe, that we can accommodate their special needs. And so we can provide those opportunities, and then those animals can become ambassadors for their wild counterparts. And then we also can look directly at field work. So we are partnering with a couple of different organizations or projects. One in particular is the Florida Reef Project, where stony corals off the coast of Florida are declining because of a virus. And so we partner with organizations around the country where we are housing corals, and our job is to keep them healthy and growing. And then when the virus can be eradicated in the ocean, those corals then can return back to the reef and help repopulate that natural space.
So there's a lot more going on at the zoo than might meet the eye. For visitors, though, just briefly, obviously you want people to have a good experience and have fun when they come to the zoo. But what do you really want people to take away from the experience of visiting?
I really want an individual to connect with an animal. Everybody will connect with something different, but I want them to find that one species that they connect with, they identify with, and they become passionate about, so they can learn about small changes in their own lives that can have a greater impact. So whether it be, you know, making sure you're recycling or eliminating single-use plastics or whatever that specific action might be, what small change can you make in your life to make that greater impact? And hopefully our animals can be the ambassadors and the inspiration for those small changes.
Anne, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. I really appreciate being a part of this.
Anne Shimerdla is president and CEO of Blank Park Zoo. And now we're going to turn to another AZA accredited institution in the state, the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. It's in Des Moines, and it is a unique organization with an unusual history. It is the only research facility in the world dedicated to the study and conservation of bonobos. The bonobo is the great ape most closely related to human beings, and the species is endangered. Many of the bonobos that live at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative have been part of a long-term study of apes and their ability to acquire human language. Kanzi is the most famous bonobo in the world. He is 41 years old. He's regarded as the first great ape to demonstrate an understanding of spoken English. He comprehends novel sentences and combines lexigram symbols to describe new objects and foods. He's one of seven bonobos who live at the initiative, where the humans work hard to enrich the lives of the apes in their care. Here's some audio of a visit I paid to the initiative back in 2018. I was standing on the roof of the building with director Jared Tagliatelle and observing the outdoor habitat available to the apes.
There were two nests, you can see. That's one on the ground over there, which is not very typical, but Inyota was sleeping in that earlier.
So wait, when you say nest on the ground, that looks like a bag. Is
no, it's a bunch of blankets, actually.
Okay.
So in the wild, bonobos make a new nest every night to sleep in, and they'll use what's available to them, branches and leaves, and they usually make them pretty high up in the trees. Our guys like to sleep high up, too, in their indoor enclosures, but we provide them with, most of the time, blankets, and they'll weave them together into these pretty elaborate and what looked to be, although I've never tried one, comfy nests. You can see evidence of one as well. This is sort of the day nests. The one they make during the day for little napping periods are usually not as involved as the night ones. But I think Tico has left his remnants on that tall tower there in that yard. And then there's another one way out there on the ground. So I think that the bonobos were enjoying watching some of the waterfowl that are around the property.
Nice.
That was Jared Tagliatelle, director of the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative, from a conversation we had back in 2018, and now he is on the line with me today. Hello, Jared.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Thank you for being back on the show. And we don't have time today to dig into the long history of the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. But I do know that when you took over at this facility, the welfare of the individual animals was first and foremost on your mind, and there were some real challenges to overcome. So can you tell me a little bit about how you and the others involved really worked hard to create an environment where the bonobos can thrive?
Yes, absolutely. So actually, I'm quite proud of the team, and I've had the good fortune of being involved with the organization basically since its beginning. And we're going on 8 years now. And like you mentioned, first and foremost for us, once we took sort of responsibility for the animals and their care, was to make positive changes in terms of animal welfare. And I kind of think I'm echoing some of the things that were said earlier, which is that for us, that really had to do with making sure that the animals had opportunities to exhibit, you know, what we might consider to be species typical behaviors, things like climbing, things like making nests out of materials that they could, you know, use to not only make a comfy spot for resting, but keep their minds and their hands and their bodies active and stimulated.
Well, and you are working with a species that is incredibly intelligent. So, I mean, thinking about enrichment opportunities, that has to be really first and foremost in the care of these animals, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they are, as you mentioned, the species along with chimpanzees that are most closely related to us. So we are really just beginning to get a picture of how complex not only their behavioral lives are, but their social lives. So they spend quite a bit of time building relationships with other individuals and an opportunity to have those experiences, not only for themselves, but sharing those experiences with other individuals is really important and really critical for their welfare. And so that's something that we need to take into consideration, not only on a day-to-day basis, but on a more longer term basis.
And your organization is, again, it's unique in so many ways, but we were just talking about Blank Park Zoo, where, of course, the public is going to come in and see these animals, and education is a huge part of the mission. With your organization, you're not open to the public, although you have had in the past, before the pandemic, school groups coming through and things like that. So education is part of the mission. But originally, this organization was founded to study the bonobos. So tell me a little bit about how you take, the mission of the organization, the science that you do, and the welfare of the animals into consideration.
Right, exactly. So a couple things. You're exactly right. Our main focus is to learn as much as we possibly can about the species that's most closely related to us. And we do that by working really in collaboration with scientists all across the globe, as well as students. And we try to learn as much as we can about the species. And we try to then in turn disseminate that information to really students of all ages. And our goal is to inspire young students, but really, again, people of all ages, to appreciate the species that's most closely related to us, because it's our belief that by inspiring individuals to care about the species that we're most closely related to, that kind of will serve as a bridge and as a connection to the rest of the natural world. I think we're in a bit of a crisis here with a lot of people not having a real opportunity to see how connected humans really are to the world around us. And in fact, maybe we could even argue that a lot of the challenges we face as a species in terms of our planet, in terms of our interaction with wildlife, I mean, even in terms of this pandemic, are really tied up in the future of all the other species that we share the planet with. And so we kind of feel that bonobos can serve as a bridge to inspire perhaps the next generation of conservationists, of researchers, to really raise awareness, not only about bonobos, but about how, as humans, we're really just another species that has to share this planet. And we want to make that future as positive as we can for all of the species, including our own.
When you took over this organization, you got involved with a family of bonobos that has been well known and part of research initiatives for a very long time. And I know I mentioned Kanzi in the introduction, and people all over the world know about Kanzi. He's an incredible creature who has taught us so much about bonobos and about humans. And when you took over, Kanzi was in bad shape. He'd been very sedentary and had eaten a lot of junk food over the years. Can you tell me a little bit about your focus on making sure that we weren't treating Kanzi as a human, but as a bonobo?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, yes, unfortunately, Kanzi was, among other things, obese. And we worked really, really hard to get him not only a species-appropriate diet, but also opportunities for a lot of physical activity and physical exercise. That included opportunities for climbing. That included opportunities for being able to forage for food, which is something that bonobos do. Basically, if they're not resting during the day or interacting with social partners, they're going to spend a good bit of their time all day, as many animals do in the wild, foraging for food. And giving Kanzi and the other bonobos those opportunities really contributed positively to his physical health. So he lost weight, he gained muscle tone, and really became a much more active bonobo. part of that also included increasing our group size. We unfortunately only had a single female. Bonobos are a matriarchal species. So female-female bonds play an important role, not only for individuals in a group, but also for the group dynamics as a whole. We were fortunate enough to bring in two females that were of emigration age. So in the wild, bonobo females typically leave their natal group. So even though they're matrilineal, it's the females that go out and join a new group, typically when they're sexually mature and ready to have babies of their own. We've been able to bring in two young females. They've had a tremendous impact, not only on our matriarch in terms of increasing her welfare, but really for the whole group, diversifying the opportunities for social interactions and giving them additional opportunities, including Kanzi, to form really strong bonds with these new individuals.
How is Kanzi doing now?
He's doing great, actually. I'm so happy to report that we just had a comprehensive physical exam on Kanzi, which included cardiac exam and a dental exam. And Kanzi is really quite fit. And we've got a great team working to keep him that way.
There are some people who really don't believe that wild animals should be used in research in any way. And obviously the welfare of the animals in your care has been a primary focus for you. But how do you respond to people who just don't think this should even be happening?
Sure. And I really like to take into consideration, and we as an organization really like to respect the views of other individuals. I think it's really important to note that none of the animals that we're talking about are going to be taken from the wild. Obviously, these are all animals that were born descendants some time ago of wild individuals. Our perspective is really quite simple. We believe very strongly that humans need to sort of reverse course in terms of habitat destruction and fragmentation. And in order to do that, we need to educate as many people as possible about the plight of bonobos, but also about other species, for example, that bonobos share their habitat with. And it's really our perspective that, like I said, we're just one species living on this planet. And unfortunately, humans as a species haven't always taken the best care of the planet. And so it's our hope that through the work that we're doing, that we're really going to be able to change enough minds and motivate enough people and inspire enough individuals to really change course and start promoting the conservation of these species and the habitats that they live in.
We've been talking a lot about the standards set by the AZA. And of course, that's not just for zoos and aquariums, but you are also accredited by the AZA. Tell me from your perspective, I mean, it seems like these AZA standards have been very powerful and really have made an incredible difference. How do you see them implemented within your world?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Dr. Renner did a wonderful job of explaining, kind of giving the listeners a real perspective on how difficult, but how challenging it is and how wonderful it is actually for the animals in AZA organizations care because the standards are so high. One of the things that we find really, really powerful and that we're particularly in tune with is this idea of looking at actually measurable outcomes for the animals in our care. So as an organization that's really based in science, we're a research organization, so we obviously depend on the data. So yes, there are lots of standards that you have in terms of what needs to go into taking care of the animal, of the animals. But for our perspective, the really important part comes in then measuring what's the impact? We have an intention. We'll introduce a new piece of enrichment or maybe a new procedure for training for healthcare. But then we can measure back out and say, is this really improving the lives, the experiences of the individuals in our care? And if it is, then great. We can keep learning. If it's not, then we're gonna keep trying to do better. You know, our perspective is that we are going to continue to do our best to enhance the welfare of the animals in our care. And as far as I'm concerned, we can always keep working to just do a little bit better.
Jared, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jared Tagliatelle is the director of the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. This hour, we've been talking about how standards have changed for the care of wild animals in captivity, driven largely by the AZA. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
It's all happening at the zoo.